Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Maria Spear-Aulis joins me and Matt Curtis and Mike Keyes, and we're bringing back the Brandeis Brief. We're going to talk about the Eclipse counterfeit glasses and whether Amazon is on the hook. Commercial photos of nature photography, are they what you think they are? Are your Facebook friends your real friends? Not according to a judge in Miami necessarily, if you are a judge. All this and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes. Episode 397, recorded September 1st, 2017. Angels want to wear my aggressively red shoes. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We hope you had a wonderful time watching the solar eclipse, that you had a great week last week while we were on hiatus, but we are back and we are thrilled to be here. We've got a great panel of folks to talk about all of the issues at the cutting edge of technology and the law, all of the very interesting legal issues that crop up at that very interesting intersection. Joining me are my two wonderful co-hosts. We've got Matt Curtis here. He's a law student at Notre Dame. Hello, Matt.
Hello, we're back in the grind at law school and looking down on all the 1Ls, which is just a wonderful thing, and excited to be back this week.
Wonderful. Great to see you again. Hope you had a good week.
Yeah, it was great.
Wonderful. And Mike Keyes is here. Mike is a partner at the Dorsey firm in Seattle. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Denise. Hi, everybody. Missed y'all last week. Great to be back. And I'm super excited that I'm not in law school right now.
I know. I'm pretty excited about that myself. Although, you know, wait, what are we about to do other than a 2-hour just about somewhere under that discussion of all of the interesting legal issues at the intersection of technology and law? So we don't want to be in law school, but we get together to talk about law stuff. I don't know. We're ill. joining us is our ill guest, Maria Spear-Aulis. Hello, Maria. Wonderful to see you.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Maria is, I haven't even gotten to know you yet, Maria, but I love you and your website so much, I'm ready to pronounce you an utterly delightful person. You're a friend of our former intern and now practicing lawyer, Franklin Graves, who's joining us in chat today. Hi, Franklin. Yes. Glad you could join us. And you're in Nashville, Tennessee, which is also where he practices. And you're the owner of a firm called Spear IP. Any friend of Franklin's, of course, is a friend of ours. You practice a lot of trademark and fashion law, music law, all manner of IP law. You're also a cook and a yogi and a singer and a fierce wearer of jeans, which all of the above, love, love, love. So it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So we've got lots in your wheelhouse to talk about this week, Maria. Let's get right into it and talk about some trademark-related and branding kind of issues. While we were on hiatus last week, there was this little thing called the total eclipse of the sun that happened, and it was last Monday. I was in the mountains when it happened. I was not in the path of totality, but Maria, you were. Tell us about what it was like in Nashville.
I sure was, and I can't even see you right now, which tells you that these are legit solar eclipse glasses. And, you know, there was an issue where a lot of folks purchased solar eclipse glasses through Amazon, just doing exactly what the ASA told them not to do, was finding something and buying it because it popped up online. To be legitimate, non-counterfeit glasses, the glasses should block out anything except for the sun, which obviously makes it very difficult to see anything except for the sun. So these two individuals, unfortunately, in South Carolina, bought counterfeit solar eclipse glasses. Didn't, for whatever reason, you know, Amazon issued recalls and emailed folks and issued refunds, and these folks didn't get the message, used their counterfeit glasses to look at the sun, experienced some hardships after that, and are now suing Amazon.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's a fascinating issue to come up in the counterfeit context. Oftentimes when we're talking about counterfeit goods on the show, we're talking about things that involve logos or brands, but that wasn't really the key issue here. It was whether the things were going to protect your eyes or not, correct?
Right. And, you know, there are all kinds of holes you can poke in the lawsuit. I actually wrote a blog post on this today, and there's a link to the complaint in there. But, you know, they brought it in federal court in South Carolina, and the Amazon terms of use, I think they call it conditions of use, make it clear there's an arbitration clause in there, and they've got kind of your standard disclaimer of warranties and kind of this little catch-all that says, of course, Amazon is not responsible and can't warrant the accuracy or truthfulness of any descriptions on its website. So, you know, that part is interesting. Seems like they're pretty
safe. It is interesting. I feel like that might be, of course, you know, you would want to advise Amazon, if it were your client as a lawyer, to take steps to have that kind of language on its site. But I wonder if it's really kind of a belt and suspenders approach, because if you walked into your corner drugstore in Nashville, the Path of Totality, I'm sure there were plenty of brick and mortar stores that were selling glasses, and the buyer beware kind of concept would apply there. If you're picking up a pair of glasses, are you going to be able to sue the store you bought them from? I guess that's kind of an open issue. If they're telling you, oh yeah, we've checked it out and these are legit glasses, buy them from us. But if they're just, you know, putting them out there, hey, we bought them in bulk, here you go, we know people are going to be interested in having these, but, you know, do you think that they would be obligated to warn if they hadn't actually vetted them?
Well, I mean, is it up to the retailer to vet them? I thought it was also interesting in the lawsuit that they didn't name the manufacturer of the glasses. They have only named Amazon. So That's maybe telling too.
Yeah, it is telling. I think it's really fascinating that this issue has come up. I doubt that this will be the only lawsuit about this. We might see other people who do try and go after various manufacturers. It was really unclear too. I bought my glasses and the glasses I gave to my family to use off of Amazon. So, you know, I was nervous about them when the reports started coming out that some are real, some are not. Be careful, make sure they block out the sun entirely, which ours thankfully did. In fact, they look just like yours, Maria. I think we probably bought the same brand. Or, you know, they're made to look like the same brand anyway. But they worked and we're fine. Nobody has any eye damage. But there was a lot of confusion on Amazon about this. I did go to the page of the glasses that I purchased, and people were very unclear over whether they were going to, you know, this particular pair was going to be okay or not. People were kind of panicky about it, and there didn't seem to be a whole lot of certainty either coming from Amazon or the seller as to, yes, you're going to be fine with these glasses. It seemed like people were staying away from that issue. Does that surprise you?
I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I know it's, you know, the ASA, I keep forgetting what that acronym stands for, but it's something like the AAS, American Astronomical Society. But they had all kinds of guidelines, and they had kind of posted a list of trusted manufacturers. So, I mean, you had some options if you really wanted to dig in and see if your glasses were functional, if they were official, you know, protective eyewear. So, I mean, again, I think the issue is the retailer responsible? The manufacturer, we can probably agree, is responsible if you're manufacturing counterfeit eyewear. But is the retailer responsible? I mean, who wrote the descriptions? I don't know. I don't know how that works.
Right. And what I was seeing was a lot of, you know, people using that question and answer feature that Amazon has and trying to get some certainty about these glasses. And really what wound up happening is a lot of people in the comments going, don't trust these, or, you know, these are great. And sure. People didn't quite get the degree of certainty that they wanted. Matt, what do you think about this issue?
Yeah, so one thing I didn't understand, first of all, is the American Astronomical Society, or that when we say counterfeit, it just seems like this is like a certain blocking mechanism, and I guess I didn't understand how manufacturers were counterfeiting a basic blocking of the sun. My other question is, though, or I guess the most interesting analysis of whether this would be liable is, it's certainly based over more longer term, would be to look at something like sunscreen. If you're getting a label that says you have SPF 50 and then you get burnt that day after you've been out in the sun all day, you know, are you able to sue the manufacturer or someone like Amazon? My inclination is that probably not. Although I didn't have the time to look into it.
Yeah, Maria, what do you think about that?
I don't know that it's up to the retailer to, you know, to check. That's kind of, I mean, when you're a retailer selling your own goods, maybe, but when you're a retailer kind of offering third party goods, is it up to you? I mean, if this were, you know, a child's toy, you know, something where they have all kinds of regulations and risk of injury and whatever, and people were maybe even using those Q&A features to figure out, you know, what experience have you had with this particular brand of whatever, where does the responsibility lie? Is it buyer beware? I think a little bit.
Yeah, again, I come back to you, if you bought them in a store and there were no representations made to you about their safety, just they were there and available, and, you know, I think maybe the assumption would be that the store owner would put the onus on the buyers to check the brand, check their functionality, check their legitimacy. But if the brand is being sold and pretending to be something that it's not, that's where it becomes problematic. You know, what if mm-hmm. it's a pair that says that it's, you know, on the approved AAS list, but in fact it's not, then that's going to open a whole can of worms. What do you think about all this, Mike?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I mean, this is largely, as I understand the issue, governed by individual state laws related to product liability claims. I think a lot of states have it in their laws that you can be liable. Anybody in the product retail chain or distribution chain is potentially liable for selling a defective or faulty product. Mm-hmm. Now, this, as Maria's pointed out, I think very correctly, the individuals that purchase these products from Amazon directly are going to have a hard time with this particular lawsuit that was brought because, one, there is an arbitration provision that you agree to as part of the terms of service, and two, there is an express disclaimer with respect to how a product functions. So for those reasons, I think this is going to be hard for these two plaintiffs that have brought this class action lawsuit. But, of course, those terms of service wouldn't be binding on third parties that happen to just use the glasses. So I think that's more of an interesting question as to what type of claims do those folks that didn't make the purchase have against Amazon and some of these other retailers.
Right. So you're thinking of the scenario where someone buys in bulk and then resells them?
Correct. Or, yeah. You know, you buy in bulk and you distribute them for free or give them to your buddies or what have
right.
you. Arguably,
right.
the people that received the benefit of your defective glasses, they wouldn't be bound by the terms of service. So, I suspect this is not a done deal by any means.
Right. And we started this discussion with our trademark bumper, and we're sort of talking about this in the context of counterfeiting and the sort of interplay of trademark to prevent the sale and you know, in some ways be a safety check on counterfeit goods. If you're buying a branded trademarked product from the original source and it's not a counterfeit product, you have some faith and assurance that the manufacturer that is associated with that brand is putting their reputation on the product. Does that all completely go by the wayside when goods are marketed, manufactured, marketed, sold from countries and companies that just don't care about their reputations?
Is that for me, Denise?
Yeah. What do you think about that?
So the question was, if a company doesn't necessarily care about the goodwill associated with the trademark, is that are they still liable potentially for defective or faulty products?
Well, I mean, when you throw China into the or Chinese companies into the equation, and they're jumping into this frenzy for these things. I don't know about you guys, but I was hearing anecdotal stories of the glasses that started out being about $2 a pair were selling for 100 and more by the time the eclipse was almost upon us. So this feeding frenzy where people would just jump in and say, oh, we've got some glasses for you, you know, and collect the buck. When there's no ability to go after those bad actors, does everything just break down?
Yeah, I mean, potentially, yeah. I think that's a real issue. I mean, to the extent that you can go after other folks that are in the distribution chain, you know, suppliers or the ultimate retailer. But yeah, I mean, that's a real problem when you got companies that really don't care, just in it to make a quick buck, and then, you know, as for all intents and purposes, are unreachable.
Unreachable, unsuable, and not accountable. So does that mean everyone else in the chain has to be accountable to make up for that fact? I just think it's a really difficult policy issue. And, you know, we don't talk a lot about products liability law on the show because it doesn't come up that much. But this is sort of a classic products law question from law school, Franklin. Look for it on your exams. I'm sorry, not Franklin, Matt. Franklin, you're long out of law school. I know you're listening. Thank God. Did I scare you? No more exams for you, Franklin, except in your nightmares. Matt, you may see this one come up.
That'll be a fact pattern that I won't be looking for. One of the things that I think is interesting is that, like, as a market responds, you know, I guess the analysis is these, you know, around the 4th of July, you tend to see fireworks displays that pop up, and the liability for them is that these are typically individuals who are selling these through third party companies who are probably outside the United States. So these unique market needs that are met once every year, once every, you know, I think the next eclipse is 2024. You know, the goodwill that we tend to associate with businesses and their basic warranties and all those provisions tend to go out the window when that doesn't happen. I'm not sure that our law is set up to distinguish between manufacturers who are set up for long term and manufacturers who are set up for short incremental bursts of production. My guess is that it would be generally set up for the long-term producers.
Yeah. And I think the takeaway from this, there are many takeaways from this, but for people who weren't paying attention to the fact that there are terms and conditions that govern your Amazon purchases and that an arbitration clause applies to those purchases, it's probably news and you should probably pay attention to it. We have a wonderful little video that you may have seen floating around on the web that we'll play you some of. I encourage you to go watch the whole thing. It's a little longer than we want to play here on the show today. But if you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw and find episode 397 there, you'll find a link to the video in its entirety, as well as everything else that we wind up discussing today in a tidy little list for you for your reference. But we'll play a bit of it for you. It you know, is one of these wonderful social experiments to see if people are paying attention to terms of service before they click on them.
We can't do anything today without first agreeing to terms and conditions. But does anyone actually read what they say? Let's find out. Does anyone want to win a free free iPad. We're doing an iPad giveaway today for charity. It's for the Pass It On organization. We're teaching people to do good things for other people. Pretty easy. I just need you to register with your name and email.
Yeah, I can do that. It's definitely free.
Yeah, it's totally free. It, basically, they're the standard terms and conditions, give or take a few things. You want to make sure you agree to the terms and conditions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Done.
Oh, but before you go, I just need the shirt off your back.
What do you mean?
Upon entry, you'll be required to donate the shirt off your back to the
All right, well, you get the idea. All she had to do was lure people in with a free iPad, and dozens of folks came along and clicked sure for the iPad giveaway. But it started with her telling them that now they were required to give the shirt off their back. It winds up with them also needing to take home, foster dogs, rescue dogs, and ultimately adopt children. It's quite a good little adventure just to watch the people's faces as the cute little girl walks up and says, "Hi, are you my mommy?" kind of thing. Yes, just another underscore that no one reads terms and conditions, as particularly where they're presented, you know, on a screen, and all they have to do is click, and that there are real world ramifications, as we've discussed before in some of these social experiments. The forcing you to adopt a child is probably not legal or enforceable, but it does make the point quite nicely. Let's talk about a few more branding issues before we leave the topic of trademarks, etc. If you're a Dunkin' Donuts person, you're now a Dunkin' person, apparently. They have decided to drop the Dunkin', much like Radio Shack decided to drop the radio. So we'll and various other things along the way. We'll see how Dunkin' goes for Dunkin' Donuts, but it seems to be following the Starbucks model, which dropped coffee because they're about more than coffee. And I think that Dunkin' wants to be about more than donuts, and they very much want to be about coffee. So there they go. Maria, any thought about this?
I just think it's interesting. I saw an article about this, and they mentioned some failed attempts. I think Radio Shack was one of them. I think Pizza Hut at some point tried to become the Hut. That was not well received, I guess, by the pizza consuming community. So, it's probably a smart move on their part.
All right. Mike Keyes, any thoughts about Dunkin' your donuts?
Well, I just hope they are still going to sell donuts. But yeah, it's probably a good branding move given where the market's headed. It sounds like people want to, or at least this particular company wants to do less of an emphasis on donuts, for health considerations and others. So it's probably a good move. We'll see. I understand it's only in a couple of test markets, or maybe even one test market, where they've rebranded. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Matt, does this impact your morning routine at all?
No. But one thing I am curious about is how effective it is actually going to be to rebranding to the consumer. I know when I think of KFC, I still think of Kentucky Fried Chicken. So I kind of wonder like how much it's actually going to differentiate. Another thing is that so companies that have tended to be more or less health conscious, you think of the fast food ones like Burger King and McDonald's, there's kind of been a binary between those who choose to say like, look, we are, for lack of a better term, fat people companies, and those who have said like, we want to be like more nutritious and more aware. And I think the data is like not clear, but companies like Burger King have more or less decided that we're going to increase our offerings of high fat things. I mean, they have salads and stuff too, but they have done less of a pull. They've pulled away from the we need to be health conscious. So it'll be interesting to see how this helps Dunkin' move that way, because they're a donut shop. So and I don't want them to get away with donuts, because although it's not my daily routine, it sometimes fits in the week.
There we go. All right. Hopefully what also fits in your week is fabulous footwear to run you around school, Matt. if you're running around in Skechers, you might find that some of the designs that you like are no longer available because Adidas has brought a successful suit against Skechers for a few pairs of shoe designs that were quite similar, and in one case using a similar name to shoes that Adidas made. This was written up at your firm's blog, Mike, by Caleb McNeely there, and who does a good job describing how Adidas prevailed here. And we've talked before on the show about the Adidas stripe. We were just talking about that recently with Gucci's stripes against Forever 21. So these seemed like pretty clear cases of infringement to me, a non-trademark lawyer. Did you think this was a difficult analysis for the court or no?
Oh, I didn't think so. One that you have on the screen right now, the Skechers Onyx, that's clearly a riff on Stan Smith's trade dress. And of course, Stan Smith, that shoe has been, you know, a fashion staple going back, you know, into the 70s and 80s. Very, very strong mark, lots of consumer recognition. And so I think it was pretty easy call with respect to the Onyx copy. There was also the evidence that was revealed during the summary judgment that the CEO of Skechers gave orders to produce a knockoff of the Stan Smith. So when you've got that evidence coupled with the visual similarities, it's what we like to call a slam dunk in trademark cases. so that's that one. The other one, I think, though, is probably a bit of a closer call. The one that you have on the screen right now. I mean, yes, there are some visual similarities, but there's quite a few differences. So, and I believe that Skechers had produced a consumer survey showing that, you know, only a very small percentage of the relevant consumers thought that there was an affiliation or connection between the two companies as a result of this shoe. So, I would say absolutely it was a clear case, easy case for the court on the first one. Second one's a closer call.
Yeah, I thought so too. And it did seem like the stripes here were almost had a functionality aspect to them, since they're the part that attaches the laces. Right. And could almost be built into the design of the shoe, just were given contrasting colors and happened to be a stripe. I don't know. This one did seem like less of a mark issue to me. And then the final one that we don't have a picture of in the article is that Adidas won against Skechers, who Adidas has a trademark shoe called the Supernova that it's been making since the late 90s. And Skechers was also selling a shoe called Supernova. I guess the issue there sort of bleeds into what we're going to talk about next with breakfast cereals, where, you know, can you take something that is a phenomenon in nature, like a circle or a supernova, and make it a mark that others in your realm can't use? Here, apparently, the court didn't have any problem saying, hey, you know, this is a mark of Adidas. You're making a product that squarely competes with them in their market, and you can't call it the same thing. Am I right about how the court came down there, Mike?
Yep, you're exactly right, and that's exactly the argument. Skechers was saying, look, we're using the term supernova in a descriptive sense to describe the nature or quality of our goods, and I think the court was able to easily dispatch that argument. You know, of course, supernova is a term that Adidas has acquired significant goodwill in, and so the court had no problem in finding that that this was an infringement. So I think it was ultimately the right decision here.
Wonderful. Anything to add, Maria? You know, go ahead. Oh,
Yeah, I was just going to say that, of course, Adidas has been incredibly successful in a lot of cases in forcing its marks. It takes branding very seriously, and some think way too seriously, especially with respect to the three-stripe trademark. So, you know, because it has accused other companies of that uses a two-stripe on shoes of being infringing, and four stripes as well. So if you're going to get into the striping business, you better think long and hard about it.
You've got all kinds of companies that'll come after you. Maria, what do you think about all this?
My impression after reading about this case was just, you know, kind of the power of consumer survey evidence when you're talking about, especially in the fashion industry, and you're talking about secondary meaning. And my other thought was, I would hate to be Skechers in the damages phase after the CEO comments come out.
Yeah, definitely. That's going to be a tough one. Matt, any thoughts?
I just have a question for anyone. Is there a strategy with bringing all three of these separate claims at once? Other than, you know, an efficiency standpoint, is there, if you had a weak one, would that be helpful for it if you have two other good ones in there?
That's a good question, Matt. You know, you might, if you had a couple of strong claims and a weaker one, you might want to fold in the weaker one. Hopefully it would be overpowered by the other two. But yeah, that's a good strategy call that you'd have to consider at the outset. Because what you don't want to do as a brand owner, particularly Adidas, that has a reputation of taking claims and taking them all the way and ultimately being successful, what you don't want to do is kind of have a setback with losing a claim. That can be more damaging than you want to than you might want. So,
right. So
great, thank you.
Yes, thanks for that clarification, Mike. Moving on to the ubiquitous circle, it must drive Cheerios crazy, and I imagine maybe it's had other litigation about this, that there are so many other breakfast cereals out there that are a circle made out of beige-colored wheat of some kind that are not Cheerios. As Maria's pointed out, there are Corn Pops and Trader Joe's O's and toasted whole grain oats and honeycombs and honeyed cornflakes that all use the color yellow, which is also associated with Cheerios. But a lot of them use the circle, too. So I imagine this has been a long battle for Cheerios, although I don't know that much about it, trying to protect their own brand and what they do. What they have recently not been able to do is lock up the color yellow as theirs and theirs alone to use when it comes to these kinds of breakfast cereals. Right, Maria?
Yeah, I wish I knew whether Cheerios has tried to protect the shape of those O's. There probably would be some kind of functionality issue there, but you know, trying to protect that color yellow and a couple of the things the TTAB cited, I wonder if they were specifically looking for O-shaped cereals and they kind of listed a few images of the different O cereals that also use yellow, kind of showing that there's no secondary meaning there. Nice try, Cheerios, I guess. But apparently their brand manager says the battle's not over, so maybe they'll keep on trying.
Right. And then this isn't the first time we've looked at cases where a brand has said that color is ours. The two that are mentioned in the Adweek piece that we have in our discussion points are Tiffany and then also Louboutin, the very high-end high-heeled shoe maker, which did get some recognition vis-a-vis Yves Saint Laurent, that they have a distinctive shoe with this red sole. But the court didn't go quite so far as to say you are the only shoe manufacturer that can have a red sole. So it's a little bit confusing how they left things there. At least I'm a little confused. Can you set me straight, Maria?
I think that in that decision, they had to they had to revise their application a little bit, and they ended up with having a valid, you know, trade dress protection in that red sole, so long as the shoe itself is not red. There was no secondary meaning if the entire shoe was red, but in a shoe that is not red, you know, they kind of have that acquired distinctiveness, I guess.
Yes. That would be a very aggressively red shoe to have the whole thing, including the sole, be red. Though I guess it's possible. Any thoughts about Cheerios, Matt?
Yeah, I think that one of the problems with trademarking colors, and I know it's limitedly been accepted by the courts, is that the color spectrum is a limited amount of space on it. So when you're looking at a competitive area like a cereal box, I'm sure it's very valuable. I believe it went up to the Supreme Court previously whether trademarks should be used on college athletics uniforms when they were looking at infringement by third parties, and I believe they said that they could. But it seems like always a tricky area of the law to cut off a unique color spectrum and probably like colors in the area. So I think it was always an uphill battle for Cheerios.
Right. And I think, you know, tying this back to the fact that we do a technology law show here, that this does impact how people present themselves online, that these color schemes are very important when it comes to user experience and UI design. Imagine, for example, if Google tried to keep any other website from being clean and white, which is, you know, such a part of its presentation. Mike, any thoughts on how these color issues transfer over to the online world?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, color, of course, can be protectable as a trademark. The U.S. Supreme Court has made that clear under certain circumstances. You know, you've got to be able to establish that you have a protectable, that essentially it has secondary meaning with respect to a particular segment of the market. So, you know, colors can be very powerful, just a single color. I mean, think of the color that Tiffany uses. I mean, it's, you know, the color in and of itself can be a very powerful indicator of source. So one thing I did want to mention, the discussion about the Cheerio box reminded me of the 1938 case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, Kellogg versus Nabisco over shredded wheat. There the court actually talked about functionality of, once a patent has expired with respect to the shredded wheats, Kellogg was able to reproduce it. So it just kind of got me thinking about that. Fun little fact for the day, 1938 Supreme Court case. Over
Thank
Syria.
You.
That's a good one.
For bringing that in, yes. All right. Well, bringing ourselves
to the court.
The opinion was written by Justice Brandeis, no less, you know, a legal giant that was opining on breakfast cereal. So,
right. Well, that I think we need to make our first MCLE passphrase for the show Brandeis Brief, then, since we've gone all the way back to 1938 and Justice Brandeis. Who can remind me what a Brandeis Brief is? Matt?
Oh, gosh. Why I don't do so well in law exams.
Quick, we're all furiously Googling. I know the phrase. How about you, Fred? Do you remember off the top of your head?
Nope, I sure don't.
All right, hold on. I'm looking it up.
Pioneering legal brief that was first in the United States of legal history to rely more on compilation of scientific information and social science than on legal citations.
Legal citations. Ah, there we go. So a Brandeis brief is bringing in things that are extraneous to the law to help a court interpret the law. Interesting.
What I do know is that he used to go like study these issues when the court was not in session. So like he would know that a manufacturing case was coming up, and he would actually go out to the location and like study what was going on while his compatriots were having a good time on vacation. So Brandeis certainly put a lot of work into it. I'm not sure if that's something we want our Supreme Court's doing, though.
That's right.
I wonder if he loaded up on shredded wheat before the Kellogg v. Nabisco case.
I bet they put the little sugary stuff on it, and he was like, all right, let's do it.
Frosted mini wheats for the win.
There you go.
All right. So Brandeis Brief is our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We're glad we've reminded ourselves and you what such a thing is. We put these phrases in the show in case you are interested in applying for CLE credit in your jurisdiction. If you happen to be a lawyer, we have put together a list that we hope assists you in that process. It's at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there, and we've got a little chart that will walk you through what may or may not be going on in your own jurisdiction. We have sometimes other professionals who listen to the show for continuing education credit in their field as well. So we love to support you if you're doing that. We find the show educational and fun. So you are pursuing those pursuits, we put these phrases in because sometimes you might be in a place where you need to demonstrate you actually watched or listened to the show. And we think that having these in there might help you out with that. So we'll put another one in the show before the end of things today. And we will move on. We will move from 1938 to a modern day where judges and others and all of us use social media and talk about the social web. So another terms of service issue here finds itself in Patel versus Zillow, which was written up by our friend of the show, Professor Eric Goldman at Santa Clara University. Interesting case where someone, again, tried to come after a website for something that they felt the website had represented to them. First of all, we were talking about Amazon earlier. This is getting into Zillow's practice of providing what's called a Zestimate, which they're very careful to disclaim to people is not supposed to be an appraisal or any kind of accurate estimate of the value of a property. This lawsuit arose because people felt that low Zestimates were damaging their property price. They did not get far with that. Here, the court took a very buyer beware kind of approach and said, no, you can't come after a website for making a guess about value. They called them non-actionable opinions on value. Matt, do you think the court got that right?
I think that I'm not sure if they got it right as in saying that as a matter of first principle, these aren't trying to reflect value and they aren't giving an opinion of value. I think the outcome's right, though. Ultimately, I think that one of these cases is actually going to go the other way, and it's going to come out on a First Amendment ground that they can aggregate data and provide useful information about the value of known of aggregate public data and provide a useful estimate based on that, which mm-hmm. And this really relates to when you have sort of gilded or protected industries that when technology moves forward, it's going to cause disruption. And part of the way that the disruption is dealt with is through legal remedies that the guilds try to bring actions against the innovative company. I'm sure that we will see this in law more as the unauthorized practice of law. And in realtors in general, when you're looking at the services that you're getting, the question is, can you get these services cheaper by doing them a la carte through some sort of web service? And the answer is probably yes. You're talking about 6% of your house value. So especially in a booming market, I think that the analysis changes when the market's not so good as it is right now. I think that this is a really interesting issue, and I do think that one of these will come out the other way, where they say that, this is the law and this is what they can do. And I think we'll see a Supreme Court case about it.
Right. The court here seems to distinguish between what Zillow's doing and what something like Wikipedia is doing, where you're crowdsourcing and sort of arriving at some degree of accuracy through the wisdom of the crowd. Of course, you can't rely on Wikipedia either, and it changes over time, but you might find that kind of information that is vetted and checked and edited by people who are devoted to doing that winds up being more accurate than these Zestimates. And I could envision, and I think the court here had in mind too, a service where maybe there was some sort of more accurate kind of crowdsourced estimate that was available, but that's not what we were talking about here. Do you agree, Matt? Did you get that out of this as you read it?
Yeah, but I think it's a really hard line drawing problem. And ultimately, the value mm-hmm. of your house is what someone's willing to pay for it. So, you know, for tax purposes, the estimator, I mean, that's really what they're determining. And so maybe the better definition would have been that, you know, you can't use a Zillow estimate for, you know, generating your tax value. But I do think it has an effect on the market. You know, if someone looks at there and says that my house is listed at $150,000 and I really think it's $300,000, you know, people's first instinct is to go to Zillow now. It's not to go ask their realtor what it is, at least people my age. So, you know, I think it gets harder and harder, and you look at machine learning, you look at the ability of Zillow to track the value of the houses, it's going to get better than what an estimator can do, you know, at least for not on the ground stuff. I guess, you know, if you're looking at the value, you know, the roof and the, you know, the drainage and all that kind of stuff, you're going to need a person to do it. But it's very conceivable that, you know, technology is going to outpace the ability of individuals to do this work. And then it would be a valid claim.
Right. Maybe Amazon's drones will fly into your home and inspect the roof and look at the view and do all the things that an appraiser now does. What do you think, Maria? Are appraisers the next field that technology is going to disintermediate here?
Well, it's just so interesting because, you know, the housing market in Nashville is just exploding right now. And so about 2 or 3 months ago, everyone got these little estimates from the city or the county or whoever it was about your taxes going up and your property value going up, but also your taxes going up. And that is based on no one's coming in and inspecting your actual home. It's purely based on the property value. So I have little sympathy, I guess, for these plaintiffs because, I mean, I guess it's perfectly clear on Zillow's website that these are estimates and not, you know, Zillow hasn't gone into these homes. And the other thing is that one of the claims was intrusion into seclusion. Gosh, that's just something I never would have thought of looking at Zillow, that it's an intrusion on your, you know, on your privacy to include your home on the website.
That sounds like something from a 1938 Brandeis brief. Haven't heard that one in a while.
I think that one of the problems is that part of your value that you're determining, I mean, so much of your value is not tied to your school. It's your location. And so, you know, the question is when I give a rating to a, you know, if I'm an education rater and I give a rating to a school that drops your school from a 5-star to a 3-star, the value of your house is going to be dropped significantly there too, just based on that. So, you know, I get that it's showing up directly on your house, but there's so many sort of valuation metrics that are creating the ultimate value of your house. I just feel like, yeah, I'm on the side of Zillow on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, I think this is absolutely the right decision. And when I was reading it, it reminded me of a similar claim that was made against another Seattle-based company, because of course Zillow is based here in Seattle as well, against Avvo. A lawyer that wasn't happy with his Avvo score sued Avvo, saying that this is essentially defamation and you're hurting my professional reputation. And the court here in Seattle ultimately threw out that class action suit, saying, no, this is protected opinion by Avvo, and how they go about giving you a score, you know, that's something that they're perfectly perfectly entitled to do. You may not like it. You may not like their methodology, but at the end of the day, it is protected opinion. So it seems to me that this is the right decision, and it falls into that Avvo line of cases.
Right. And I'm not sure I have too many tabs open and too many bits of information and feedback coming back to me, but someone chimed in that the Amazon drone wouldn't be able to tell if your house had termites. I think it could. You know, around here, when homes have termites, you can sometimes see them swarming. And if you can't see that, you can certainly see the damage they do. You can see if there's, you know, little holy bits in your wood or little piles of termite droppings. Go ahead.
Wow. And a computer is going to be able to determine, you know, vibrations where an individual wouldn't be able to. So they're going to be able to see and scope out the inside of your home a lot better than, you know, any individual can. It's the same in microbiology. When you're looking at the inside of a cell, like a computer can detect variations where no human could.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. So appraisers, go out and appraise while you can, because the drones may be coming for you. But in the meantime, don't rely on your Zestimates, because you're not going to be able to come after Zillow for their inaccuracy. All right. In Miami, we have a court who has recognized that Facebook friends aren't always real friends, or that a Facebook friendship doesn't equate with a real friendship in such a way that a judge would have to always recuse themselves from a lawyer who shows up in their courtroom and happens to be a Facebook friend of the judge. So yay, Miami, for getting this right, and for recognizing that social media has evolved, and that maybe in the early days of Facebook, the people that you were friends with there would have been actual IRL friends. But one of the things that was interesting from this opinion is the judge pulling out that Facebook uses these clever algorithms to lead people to accepting friend requests from people they barely know. So in other words, you're sort of almost duped into some of the people you might be friends with on Facebook, and they're not assuming that judges, or requiring judges to be so savvy that they would always be able to say no to that kind of thing.
I think that this is, you know, one of those things that it kind of speaks for itself. Of course, all of your friends aren't your Facebook friends. And I think that there was an interesting, you know, when we think about recusal in general, which I think this case ultimately resolved around, this is kind of it's kind of a gray area of the law. I mean, you can remember when Justice Scalia had a case having to do with the then Vice President Dick Cheney and their hunting buddies, right? So it's also merely a decision of whether they can treat, you know, whether the judge can treat them as a as their role as a citizen or a plaintiff, or as not one. So I'm sure that the law is more developed for lower courts, but it's more of a gray line than a fine line, and it seems arbitrary to put the fine line on Facebook friends.
Yeah, absolutely. Maria, do you agree?
Yes, definitely. Yep. I mean, like you said, I think, you know, when Facebook first came around, sure, you were friends with your college buddies and that's it. And now it's just, you know, I probably am friends with a couple of people that I haven't actually met in person. So I think the court got it right.
Yeah. And even if, even if the algorithms aren't as tricky as maybe what the court was getting at, there could be instances where, you know, and at Facebook in particular is moving to this model where they want people to participate in interest groups. They want people to get together and chat with one another in group fashion around things that they're passionate about, be they books or movies or what have you, causes. And in that situation, it seems like we're moving more and more toward people being not in real life friends with one another, but possibly friends on Facebook. And there they might have a more concrete connection, but they, you know, it's not the kind of connection that you would think, that lawyer walks into that judge's courtroom, there's a definite conflict of interest there. So it's nice to see courts taking that into account and issuing this kind of determination. Let's move on. This is one of my favorite kinds of issues to talk about on the show. It comes up over and over again, and it's this weird sort of place that we are technologically and societally in what constitutes a commercial activity and what does not. And there's a really interesting article at Outside Magazine that's titled "Why Your Instagram Nature Shot is Breaking the Law." And it goes right to that issue and points out that more and more people are getting outside and taking great photos. You know, our camera technology is getting better than it's ever been. And our ability to share those photos with a wide audience is getting better than it's ever been. And the distinction between who's a professional photographer and who just happened to take that great shot. Speaking of the eclipse, I hope you guys have all seen some of the wonderfully eclectic shots of the eclipse. And, you know, a lot of those were taken by professional photographers, but a lot of them were just ingenious eclipse enthusiasts who managed to get their filters and timing and composition beautifully aligned and took and shared these photos. So this Outside Magazine article points out that there is a hazard if you're outdoors and taking photos on Park Service land, Forest Service, Park Service, et cetera, that you're supposed to get a commercial filming or photography permit if you are photographing or filming on such land for commercial purposes. So what's commercial? You know, if you're posting to Instagram and Instagram is putting ads around what you do, does that make it commercial? If you are somehow not directly accumulating money from what you've posted, but you're hoping to build your reputation as a photographer, does that make it commercial? So the takeaway of it is, if you are someone who enjoys taking outdoor shots and posting them to social media, you should pay attention to this permitting issue. And it's not just the permit that you might need to use the land. It's not just your camping permit, for example. This is a separate commercial film and or photography permit that can be expensive to get and lengthy to get. The article points out at Yosemite, it typically takes less than 30 days and costs $200 to $300 to apply for such a permit, and between $50 and $1,000 per shoot day, depending on how many people are involved and whether the production is big enough to require a Park Service monitor. That's not much for a two-day TV commercial, but it's outrageous if you're just trying to chronicle your climbing buddies scaling a big wall for an adventure film, which is, I think, you know, as they are getting at there, the more likely modern scenario, more numerous, more voluminous, that you've got people in the park that are maybe going to make some commercial use out of what they're doing there, but they're not thinking of it in terms of, gee, we need to get a filming permit for this, because they're not making a television commercial or a Hollywood production movie. What do you think about this, Maria?
Well, I think, like you said, the question is, what is commercial? I mean, just because you're not making a commercial film out of something, you know, doesn't make it not commercial. If you're a photographer, or if you're not, if you're a some kind of personality, or even a non all-star athlete, and you have an Instagram account and you're hiking with your buddies and you take a photo, does it make it commercial because somehow that photograph is promoting your career or promoting your image, or, you know, of course, in the case of a photographer, yeah, it's maybe promoting their services. I think those things might make, you know, a creative work commercial.
It might indeed. Matt, what do you think? Are you going to think twice before you go to your next national park and start snapping away?
No, I'm not. I ultimately think that these are one of these like incredibly, exceptionally difficult line drawing problems. And if we look at like other cases that have had similar questions of, you know, different rules for commercial activity and non-activity that do not like fit with the underlying premise of the goal. So if you look at a national parks rule, I'm sure it was intended to somehow, you know, it's designed for the class of people who are coming in and shooting movies and who are therefore going to damage either the experience for somebody else or the natural resources themselves. So for that sort of activity, you know, when you had old cameras that really that cost a lot or something like that, or that were just bulky, and it was a bigger ordeal than it is today. Like, technology had just moved to the point where, like, incredibly capable cameras are going to fit in your backpack, and therefore you're not going to A, distract the other individuals who are enjoying the nature, and B, you're not going to necessarily destroy the nature itself. So when you see organizations that are trying to enforce an old, more outdated law in this age and justifying it on a commercial, non-commercial base, I mean, if I go in and shoot a documentary that's for a nonprofit organization, does that somehow fundamentally change, or does that more protect either of those goals for the National Park Service? And I just don't think it does. So I just think it's a really troubling – or not troubling, just a difficult distinction to try to uphold, and I'm not sure that it meets their goals.
Right, exactly. And I think that it's one of those situations where we're going to have to, you know, rely on the people who benefit from these permitting schemes to not abuse them, to not go overboard and – decide that something is something that should be subject to an expensive permit when the value that's being derived out of those works is either difficult to quantify or if you can quantify it, pretty small. What do you think, Maria?
Yeah, it's... I agree. I think I agree with Matt's points about, the purpose of it all.
All right. So one other social web story before we move on has to do, we've talked lately about influencers on Instagram and elsewhere. The Fyre Festival comes to mind, and the people that got on board to help promote the festival that did not happen. But this was an interesting twist on that. In the influencer scenario, you have brands paying people to shill for them and be their mouthpiece. But what you also are seeing a lot of on Instagram that it bears calling out and paying attention to is the unpaid folks who are being leveraged by brands. And perhaps what they get out of it is just a bit more exposure when they participate with a brand in helping build the brand. But it's revolves around hashtags and participation with a brand, whether the brand says, we're going to do a promotion and if you take this kind of picture of our product, hashtag it and we'll reshare and blah, blah, blah. But what winds up happening is there are some brands out there. Here's the one that's called out by the Fashion Law blog, something called Away, which has 676 Instagram posts, but 600 of those are user-generated, and that's by people going ahead and volunteering that their own photographs can be used by the brand. So it's sort of the opposite of the influencer approach. If you're not that big an influencer, we're happy to reshare your work, but we're not going to pay you. And there are some people here who are mentioned in the article who, have brought up the subject when they've been approached by the marketing department. Gee, do you have a budget for any of this? And they're told no, no budget, be happy that we're acknowledging your existence basically and helping you build your own brand, I suppose. But I just think it's a pretty interesting phenomenon and one that largely seems to be running along without too much legal friction now, but could become more problematic down the line. As you pointed out, as we were prepping for the show, Maria, L'Oreal actually has some terms of service that it attempts to get to apply to these kinds of situations where it tells users by responding hashtag yes L'Oreal Pro or uploading content to our image gallery, you agree to the following, and they do the typical worldwide perpetual royalty-free non-exclusive license that you see in a lot of different places around the web. And those crop up quite a bit. But here's an instance where I think you've raised a really good point, Maria, that just by putting this out there, L'Oreal doesn't know who they're contracting with, or if, especially dealing with folks on Instagram, they even are dealing with people of sufficient age to form a legal contract.
Right. Where are they located? How old are they? I don't know what the minimum age is to use Instagram, but say it's 13 or 16, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. can these people enter into a contract? And to the extent they're image or likeness is featured in the photo, you know, depending on state law, can the minor, you know, allow them to use their image or likeness?
Right. I think it's worth just sort of flagging or bookmarking as an issue that might, you know, we have definitely seen legal issues crop up around these influencers who are being paid. I think we could start to see them crop up around the ones who aren't being paid as well. What do you think, Matt?
You know, I'm not sure that this is going to be one of those issues that really crops up. I think that ultimately they're doing, you know, I think the alternative is that they're not sending out these and they're not asking people. But when you think about, like, I pay Notre Dame to represent their brand all the time because I'll buy a T-shirt and I'll walk around and it'll be in my Facebook photo. You know, the really like I think that, like, the nature of branding and the nature that we wear clothing and we wear our glasses and we wear all kinds of consumer products that we're representing. I'm not sure that it fundamentally changes the analysis because it's in a photo. Now, and I do think that they're covering most, like, not from a formal legal perspective, but just from a perspective of equity. I think that this company is doing a good job of checking their bases, and you know, I think that, you know, there may be some errors with underage individuals and that sort of thing, but for the most part, I think that reaching out and asking and saying, hey, we're not paying anything, you know, if you want to be part of our brand, that's great. I think that's a pretty solid way to go about it.
All right, Mike, any thoughts?
I agree with that, with what Matt was saying. I also agree with Maria. I think this could be a little bit of a tricky issue. As I understand it, Instagram, you have to be 13 years old in order to have an account. I personally know that there are lots of kids that are under the age of 13 that have Instagram accounts, including my youngest daughter. So yes, I suppose that this could be an issue ultimately. So yeah, I agree with you, Denise. An issue to flag for future consideration as this develops.
Right. All right. We have two lawsuits to flag for current consideration before we wrap up the show today. They're both pretty interesting. They both involve Hollywood music and or entertainment. We've talked about VidAngel before on the show when they were subject earlier this year to a preliminary injunction that caused them to stop what they were doing. They actually didn't stop quick enough. This was back in January of this year and got hit with some sanctions for not curtailing their activities quickly enough as far as the court was concerned. But what VidAngel is all about, and they're kind of an interesting company. They're based out of Provo, Utah, and they are attempting to provide a service that filters objectionable material, basically provides on-the-fly parental controls for videos. They started out in the DVD realm. They are now trying to transition, and this isn't involved in the decision that just came out, or I think they would probably like some clarification about whether the decision that just came out affects their current business model, because they seem to be trying to move into, we're going to give you a service that works with Netflix and Amazon streaming, which again gets into terms of service issues, because both of those companies have terms of service that say you cannot mess with, alter, manipulate the code of our streams. So for VidAngel to actually provide that service, they would have to get over that hurdle, provide it with the permission of Amazon and Netflix anyway. So they have been found, though, to be infringing in their service, that they're providing a service that basically provides unauthorized, unlicensed copies of movies, And they attempted a bunch of arguments as to how their alterations might be fair use or otherwise some kind of authorized copy. They floated the argument that, well, we originated with an authorized copy because we have these purchased DVDs that we then go from. The court didn't think much of that argument. And now they have decided to leave the injunction in place. And it basically destroys VidAngel's DVD business model that they've been operating under. Have you been paying attention to VidAngel, Maria, and these recent developments?
It's so interesting. I never would have thought there was a market for this service, but apparently there is, or they wouldn't exist. My favorite quote from the Ninth Circuit was that, you know, virtually every pirated copy of a movie starts with a legitimate copy. So that kind of gets to the crux of VidAngel's argument, I think.
Right. And the thing about the case that has always sort of seemed to me to be like a Skechers CEO issue for VidAngel is that although they claim to have this good and laudable and legitimate business model purpose of providing cleaned up copies of movies to people who want them. And I read on your website, Maria, that your fur family are pets at this point. No small humans running around at this point in your life. So for those of us with small humans who have, you know, gotten them to a certain age, there have been times in my life where I would have welcomed something like this, even though they're targeting a more, I think, faith-based market, but certainly there's a broader market to even secular parents that, you know, there's some things that maybe you would prefer to be able to blip right over or just not show. The Sir Galahad part of Monty Python and the Holy Grail comes to mind. There were years that I used to skip through that and my son would go, "What? We never watched that part of the movie. Why?" Oh, you know, when you're older. So there are certainly times when it would be nice to have an easy way to do that. But having experienced VidAngel as a consumer, the experience that I had is the filtering was very much after the fact that you paid them their money. They were renting movies for a buck a movie. So they were definitely doing some price undercutting. And there was a box you could take. Oh, would you like to apply any filtering to this movie? Oh, no? Okay. Then go on and watch the movie. So, I mean, it definitely seemed like they had some issues that weren't going to play well before a court if it got right down to it. Matt, any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I think that their first business model is not nearly as compelling or not nearly as interesting a question as their second business model. Like, it was pretty clear that they were just selling unauthorized copies. The interesting question is whether can I put – like, if I'm watching a streaming service, can I put a filter on it in any way? You know, you can imagine that if Google Glasses, for instance, had ever taken out – if the glasses themselves were providing the function of filtering – content out, would that be in some way a copyright violation, whether it's for a derivative work or for the underlying work itself? I think that that'd be a really, really hard line to draw and to take out that I can't have some, you know, I can't have some third party, you know, addition or visualization that's going to change the experience of the underlying copy. But I'd just be interested to see what you guys have to say.
Maria, any response?
Yeah, I the Google Glass issue is interesting. I don't know where I would sit on that issue. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely think we're getting into an arena, especially with AR and VR, where manipulation of the original work is going to get to a point where maybe there are stronger fair use arguments to be made than redigi. I'm thinking forward to our next story that VidAngel had to make here. You know, I definitely, in some senses, I am sad as a parent that we don't have better technology for this. I just don't think that VidAngel has managed to crack yet how to do it. They haven't approached it in a way that I think is going to be legally viable. And maybe the studios themselves are going to figure out a way to do that. Maybe they don't want the VidAngels of the world to drag them along the way Napster dragged the music industry into something that people wanted. As you point out, Maria, you'd probably need a bigger demand for the service than...
Or maybe it could be up to Disney or whoever to do the culling themselves. Maybe they want to maintain those rights.
Right.
Go
ahead.
There is interesting copyright exemptions for... when you think about reading, there's copyright exemptions for I believe that for people who are vision impaired can have it transmitted to audio, or maybe it's for people they can braille. But although there are exemptions for limited markets that individuals have cut out, and so whether this is something that would really render the market useless is an interesting question. But ultimately, like the way they went about their first business model, like it just was so like blatantly a violation of the copyright law that any question that they were going to have the judge like look at them favorably just went out the window.
Right. Victor in the studio is telling me of Sony debuting clean versions of 24 movies. So maybe it is cool. Something that's going to... Yeah. To devolve to the studios to do, or if it, if it doesn't, if they don't start meeting that demand a bit, then someone other than VidAngel is going to come along and do this in a way that might well pass legal muster. So I mentioned Redigi. We've talked about them on the show a lot. This is the company that where the first sale doctrine is involved, whether you can resell digital music files is the issue involved in the case. And there was a big hearing held in a case involving Redigi. Mike, can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, sure. This is a very important case that we're watching in the copyright space, as you mentioned, dealing with used digital music. So Redigi is this service that you could purchase or sell, I should say, used audio files, songs that you no longer wanted to listen to. And Redigi was ultimately enjoined a number of years ago now by the trial court. The case is up on appeal before the Second Circuit. And so the key issue really is under the fair use, under the first sale doctrine, Section 109 of the Copyright Act, whether Redigi has the right to offer this service where people can essentially deposit your used audio files that you no longer want to listen to and allow Redigi to ultimately resell those. Very important case because obviously this is a potentially huge market, not only for used music, digital music, but also used books. I know vendors like Amazon are going to watch this case and the developments closely. It's being considered by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Two of the judges on that panel are Judge Laval, Pierre Laval, and John Newman, widely considered both of them to be two of the best, most astute copyright judges in the country. So I think we're going to get a very well-reasoned, very well-thought-out decision. My personal bet is that the injunction will be upheld. This is something that ultimately the Supreme Court may need to weigh in, and then ultimately maybe Congress to decide whether Section 109 applies in a digital world.
All right. We will stay tuned for the decision from the Second Circuit. Matt, anything you want to add?
Yeah, this just harkens back to the Supreme Court's recent decision in the patent area, which does not have a first sale doctrine. But the Supreme Court just said that in the context of the patent industry, there is a first sale doctrine. And so one of the main arguments in this case is that that the first sale doctrine is not specifically authorized for the digital content. And so using the Supreme Court's reasoning, which harkened back to Sir Edward Coke in the 1600s, for that property is by the nature of property, it's the first sale doctrine applies. I really can't imagine the Supreme Court coming out another way. I think it really draws a very, very difficult line drawing problem then, looking backward between what type of items were licensed and which type of items were sold. It'll be an interesting one to watch, though.
It will be. Maria, any thoughts?
Yeah, this is so interesting. I almost want a computer science person to explain to me exactly how the technology works, because it seems like if it is truly the same copy, the same MP3 or whatever file it is that is being moved to Redigi and it no longer exists on the consumer's computer or the user's computer, wouldn't the first sale doctrine apply? I guess it depends on what the material object is, right? As if a file can qualify as a material object, because, a material object would be like a book that you're selling secondhand. So it's very interesting to me.
Right. And there are very interesting aspects of copyright law where making a copy is not deemed an infringement in the search arena, for example. So I do think that all of that comes into play in this case and ultimately is going to factor into the analysis. Well, two people were going to chime in, so please do.
Yeah,
go ahead,
so I think Maria really hits on the very interesting technology issue here. Redigi's lawyer during oral argument used this little visual prop. He took a book like this book I have here and said, here is the original copy that was downloaded from iTunes. And if I move it over here and put it down on this part of the table, it's still the same book. I've just moved it. And so he said, that's exactly what's happening here. This file is transferred. I think he said it's like a pieces of a puzzle. And you move one piece of the puzzle and you put it over here and the other pieces follow quickly thereafter. And you just have a copy that's essentially been disassembled and reassembled in another location. So it's, for all intents and purposes, it is the same copy. So I agree. That's a very interesting technological issue that the court's going to have to grapple with. And the court really got into it. This oral argument lasted like nearly an hour and a half. And mm-hmm. That's an extraordinary amount of time for an appellate court to consider an argument. So I think it's really a signal that these judges are taking this very seriously. And it's a very important case.
Matt, you too?
Yeah.
Final
yeah,
thoughts?
Just the interesting thing is, I think that is a bit of an oversimplification of how the computer technology actually works, which I would do if I was their attorney as well. But you are actually destroying another copy. And in order to ensure that there is only one copy made, is that you could have already made the copy and transferred it to another, like it could be go from your iPhone to your computer. And so you could have two digital copies on there. They were just authorized previously. And so if you have two copies in two different spaces, that would be a problem. The more interesting analysis would be if there was some blockchain-like mechanism to track each individual buyer and each individual seller, then you could have a mechanism where there was first sale doctrine. So I hope that the court gets advice on that although it's not necessarily possible to ensure that all the old copies were destroyed previously, it is possible to do it going forward. It just may take a setting up of a system for that.
Here we go. Well, so I definitely advise people to wait until the Second Circuit decision comes out, but wonderful business model idea to do Redigi in a blockchain type fashion and see if that flies better. I meant to add our second MCLE passphrase a while back. I added it to the rundown, so I know what it is, but I haven't told you guys yet. It's going to be Matt Pays Notre Dame is our second phrase. Which
too
you
much.
Do.
Can we put
in
too
space.
Much in there?
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm going to tease next week's show a bit, because we definitely want to talk about YouTubers Etha and Hila Klein winning their copyright case, their very, very significant fair use copyright case. H3 Productions is their YouTube channel. And Franklin Graves has actually written an article for TubeFilter all about it. So if you can't wait until next week, we do not have time to do justice to this story this week, but we'll get to it next week. But if you can't wait, we do have Franklin's article, or I will put it in our discussion points. It's not quite there yet, but it's up at TubeFilter. So definitely, if you need to delve into what happened there, check out Franklin's piece, and we'll talk about it more next week. In the meantime, we're going to go out as we do every week with our animal selfie of the week, tip of the week, and resource of the week. Let's start with the animal selfie, shall we? So our current week's animal selfie of the week is a pine marten, first one seen in Yorkshire for 35 years. Let's go ahead and play it. There it is. It was caught on a trap camera. No evidence of pine martens in Yorkshire, England before this. Since the early 1990s when they found a pine marten skull. So it's nice to see this one up and about, and clearly can't be the only pine marten in Yorkshire. So it's nice to see that this trap cam is showing that they've had a little resurgence. They're cute little animals. From the legal standpoint, this is an animal selfie that the animal does not know about. So I don't know if PETA would be able to interject and say that the animal has the copyright, because it was not the photographer. But the complication here, of course, is because it is a trap camera, no one is technically the photographer, except for maybe the person who set up the camera and captured said pine marten in Yorkshire. Cute little critter. Hope you have enjoyed it. Our resource of the week is courtesy of New Media Rights, somewhere where intern and co-host Emery Roan has interned in the past as well as here. This is something that you can sign up for and subscribe to if you are an independent creative person. Say you have a YouTube channel, say you are a photographer who goes out into nature and wants to make sure you've got your permitting lined up as much as you can and your works are protected. New Media Rights has an email course, a free email course that provides an overview of the IP laws you need to know about to build your creative business. They're going to tell you what is protected, if you have to register anything, how you go about doing that, if you'll need a lawyer, how long your protection lasts, etc. Great little resource. Why not? It's free. So just wanted to throw that your way from New Media Rights. You can find it on their site. And then our tip of the week is going to be courtesy of Maria, who has a similar resource that you may be able to explore on her site. Maria, what's our tip?
So I was going to say, when it comes to independent creatives, you know, especially startups or people that are kind of starting business on a shoestring, a lot of folks use free, quote unquote, free fonts or stock photos to make the websites look prettier. And so the tip of the week is to just remember when you're building a site and using free fonts or stock photos, read those terms of use, make sure that they're actually free, that you can actually use them in connection with your business, that commercial purpose that we talked about today, but make sure that you can use them in a way that you actually are intending to use them. And you will find that tip and more on my basic legal checklist for modern brands. There it is. And it runs through topics like business entity formation, copyright, trademark, contracts, compliance, things like contest rules and email marketing, and tech, things like your terms of use, privacy policy, all that great stuff that we love to talk about.
That's great. And how can people lay their hands on the whole checklist?
So go to my website, Spear IP. It's spear-ip.com. It's actually a hyphen, spear-ip.com. And you can sign up right there on the website.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that, Maria, and for joining us this week on This Week in Law. It's been really, really fun chatting with you.
Thank you. I've loved being here. I feel smarter after talking to you all.
Oh, well, thank you. We feel much smarter after getting to know you, too. Anything going on in Nashville that you want to let us know about before we sign off today?
Oh, gosh. I mean, enjoy the long weekend. I think everyone's looking forward to it.
Yes, very much so. Mike, you going to get out and take some nature photos?
Not in any national parks, that's for sure. I'm going, my son is playing football in University of Washington Husky Stadium on Saturday night. So we're going to go.
Very cool.
He doesn't play for the Huskies, at least not yet. But his high school is playing there on Saturday night, so it should be a lot of fun. So we're going to do that.
That's going to be great. Wonderful. Have a great time. And everybody enjoy their holiday weekend. Poor Matt, though, you'll be studying away.
This is the opening game weekend at Notre Dame.
Oh, good.
Go Irish.
We do not study on Saturday.
Now not the time for me to tell you I went to Michigan.
I actually read that earlier and decided not to think about it the whole time. We do have you on the schedule next year, so hopefully we will not go 4-8 this year and can actually like hold our heads high. But we'll see. We need Mike's son to come to Notre Dame, so no going to the Huskies.
Oh yeah, he's all about the Irish.
Good.
Well, everyone enjoy their various outdoor and indoor pursuits over the weekend. We will see you next week on This Week in Law. We're so glad that you've been able to join us. We'll remind you that you can check out all of the episodes of This Week in Law if you'd like. If you go to twit.tv/twill, our entire archive of shows is there for you for your viewing and listening pleasure at your leisure. We love it if you join us live when we record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. You can do that by going to twit.tv/live, I believe it is, and joining us there. Or if you just go to twit.tv, I think there's a big button at the top of the page that says watch live now, and you can get there that way too. We love it when you join us live. You can jump into IRC and play along with us during the show. We enjoy that thoroughly. But again, we're just happy that you join us however, whenever you can, and that you get in touch with us between the shows to let us know if you have good ideas for people we should invite on as guests. That's always helpful. If you have good ideas for topics, if you have further thoughts about what we've already discussed, you can shoot us an email. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. Great way to get in touch there, or find us on Twitter. We've had our Twitter handles up throughout the show if you're watching the video, but if you're doing the audio only version of the show, I'm D Howell there. Matt is Law Pint and Mike is J Michael Keys. You can also find Maria, our wonderful guest from this week, also on Twitter at SpearIP, all one word, and on Instagram at Logos of Nashville. So thanks so much again, Maria, for joining us. Thanks to all of you for being with us this week, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.